your host and lover of most things innovation. All right, so here's my question. Why do so many innovations fail? I think the most recent stat I read claimed that 97% of new product ideas fail before they even hit the 1 year mark. Those are not great odds for those of us trying to build new products, services, internal processes, whatever it is. That's a really high failure rate. Low odds, don't you think? But not for Taylor Dawson, who was the co-founder of GE's First Build Innovation Lab. They had a high success rate, and I'd say that they were high, especially given that they were operating inside a large system with lots of processes and bureaucracies. So Taylor stopped by Inside Launch Street to share with us how to increase our success rates and drive innovation that sticks in the marketplace. But most importantly, he talked about the process for getting there, the experimentation, the communication, the optimization. Now, Taylor's innovator archetype is risk taker tweaker, and you're going to hear a lot of that in this podcast. And you're going to hear how he leveraged that for success when he was with First Build, and how he's leveraging that even today as the founder of Giddy, which helps establish companies evaluate and launch new businesses. Listen for his language around taking risks, around taking leaps, around being uncomfortable, and his language around optimizing and adjusting as you learn. That's the tweaker side. Okay, let's dig into this one.
Taylor, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here, Tamara. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. So since we're new to each other, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Yeah, I go crazy for anything around cooking. So last October for my daughter's eighth birthday, I made her a peking duck, following painstakingly all 20 steps of the Chef Steps recipe, including inflating the duck with an air compressor to get the skin detached from the body, and deep frying it and basting it and hanging it in the fridge and all that stuff. And so I tend to go the long way around when it comes to cooking. Most of them interested in learning new things about cooking. In fact, I'm building a deck in my backyard so that I can put a pizza oven on it. So pains I go to get something great. And the first pizza that comes in I'll probably be, I don't know, 300 hours into the project before I get my first pizza.
So I have to ask, is it the process that you like, the output? Like, what is it that draws you to cooking?
I think it is connecting the process with an outcome. So I'm very interested in the technicalities that go into making great food. Now, of course, I love enjoying the food, but I find it much more enjoyable to think about what went into making the food and to understand why one thing, you know, you make something one time and it doesn't turn out, and why certain different inputs made a better output. So
I feel like that kind of is in line with what you do for a living too. So let's dig into that. But I'm always curious about food in particular, because I don't love to cook. I love to eat. So I love to go out to eat, but I love how flavors come together. You know, like that's my, like that to me is amazing that someone could figure out that these two flavors go together, and I would never put them together. So anyway, so let's set the stage for listeners. Tell me about First Build at GE Appliances, and then I think we'll expand from there.
Yeah, about 4 or 5 years ago, GE was going through this GE corporate, the big GE was going through this experiment where they were trying to bring in the thought process from the startup world. So Jeff Immelt hired Eric Ries, the author of The Lean Startup, to come in and be one of our key consultants. And he went around to every business and taught people how to act like a startup. And the belief was that we could take the principles that had been developed for the startup world, adapt them for the corporate world, and turn out a bunch of new innovative products and services. So I got involved when I heard about that. I read the book. I started, actually pitched an idea to executive management. They liked the idea and hit a bunch of roadblocks. So wasn't able to actually commercialize the product in terms of getting the product out into the field, which was what we'd agreed we wanted to do. Wasn't able to take the customer's money, which was like the key thing that you're trying to do with Lean Startup. wasn't able to figure out how to manufacture the product because our factories didn't want to take it on. And so we realized...
So basically nothing to bring the idea to life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we did this as kind of an experiment and we found out there were a bunch of obstacles. So First Build was the embodiment of how you do things entrepreneurially that was tailored to what GE Appliances needed. So GE Appliances, obviously, they make physical products. I think a lot of the lean startup stuff was designed and developed for in an environment that was a software environment. And so what we figured out was we needed a space where we would be able to make any appliance product. That means bending the sheet metal, welding things, welding parts together, rapid prototyping parts that could become part of a minimum viable product. So it's got the manufacturing side, but also it's a place where we could establish a new brand. So the First Build brand actually is a brand of appliances now, and it's a place where we could sell product, which is something that was probably the scariest part of the whole experiment, was being able to allow the small number of people who work at First Build to make a decision about which products they're going to launch and be able to actually establish a relationship, a paying relationship with customers. So, I mean, basically what we did was we took those first set of experiments we ran around Lean Startup. We figured out what wasn't working at GE Appliances, and then we adapted and built a new organization that would allow us to get new products into the market.
All right, this is so fascinating. So let me back up for a second. When you say you ran into all these roadblocks, will you share with us what some of those were? Like, why did that first trial not work?
Yeah, so the first trial we did, there were 10 or more, maybe 10 to 15 different experiments that were run. I was running a team of engineers that was developing making refrigerator. So the Keurig that sits on your countertop, we were trying to develop a module that would allow you to put that in a refrigerator.
God, that would be amazing. Yeah.
So our hypothesis in that lean startup model was that people would prefer to have something built into their refrigerator, which every home in the U.S. has a refrigerator in it.
Right.
So they would prefer having it built in as opposed to having it on the countertop, and they'd be willing to pay for that. So the test that we wanted to run was to go to current owners of refrigerators, ask them to pay $200 for an upgrade, and we'd send a service person out there and upgrade the refrigerator. We had the email addresses and some consumer information from some of these people who had agreed to be contacted about projects in the future. And so what the problem was, I pitched the idea that we were going to do this thing, exchange the refrigerators out and take people's money to executive leadership. And everyone thought that it was a perfect example of how to do lean startup. And so they gave us the stamp of approval. They told us you can spend the next 3 months working on this project, and then said, go for it. And I don't think it was expected that we would run into the roadblocks. I think it was to get the product out to market. But we had the whole design done within a month or so, get into the factory, and the factory was just, they're buried under the product they're making. So the idea of making 10 units of a product in one of GE Appliances' factories that make 100,000 or more units of anything a year, when they had just launched a new line of appliances and were trying to optimize that line of appliances,
right,
wasn't a fit.
No.
And then you go and you talk to the brand about launching this product, and they'd say, no, this hasn't gone through all your reliability testing. It's not going to go out the door. Not really able to compensate for the fact that this is really only 10 units, and the risk of launching a product that doesn't have as high reliability is not as big of a deal. That those two things were, a thing. But then the biggest issue, I think, was we were going to actually have a direct relationship with consumers, which isn't something that which GE Appliances only does in limited areas. And so we didn't have a way to take money. We didn't have a way to handle the personal information, all of the things that tend to raise concerns with the accounting and the legal organizations. So we had to work through all of those issues in order to launch First Build.
So it's fascinating to me on many levels, but one is you mentioned something about selling. And in this part, and in kind of what you were saying before, talk to me a little bit about why selling is so important. And, you know, part of the reason I'm asking is, to me, an idea is only good, is only as good as people's willingness to pay for it. Yeah. So if they won't open up their wallets, it doesn't matter how great you think it is in the conference room. If someone's not willing to invest time, money, energy into it, it doesn't matter. Is that part of why you did that?
That is the one most critical piece of any project that we get involved in. Whether, you know, it's the business that I'm now for GE Appliances or any project that we ran at First Build, it was always about getting to the point where we had customers that were willing to pay money for it as quick as we possibly can. Because I think most businesses spend a lot of time doing focus groups and talking to consumers, and then they take what has been done in those focus groups and they translate it into a spec. They develop the software, the service, or the product. And then they launch the product 2 years later, and they find out whether or not there's interest in the product. And so the key insight that we got from this experience that we'd done with the Lean Startup and the learnings we had from Eric Ries were that we really should get to that interaction with the consumer as quickly as possible. And so what we did at First Build was actually designed to allow us to get to the consumer interaction and the point at which they would have to exchange money with us as soon as we possibly could. And that obviously is very uncomfortable for a company that's used to having all their I's dotted and their T's crossed before they ship a product and get involved with customers.
Now, were you asking for the full price? Were you asking for a minimal price? And I know it sounds like a nitpicky question, but, you know, I'm assuming, and tell me if I'm wrong, that you put, to your point, the minimum viable product out there, which meant it's not perfect yet. Were you, and I know you were trying to get feedback, so were you looking at this as let's test the price point, or were you looking at this as let's see if people will open up their wallets at all?
I think it's see if people open up their wallets at all, because that's infinitely better than the typical experience that you start with consumers, which is just asking them questions. You know, so the worst thing you can possibly do is go and ask customers if they like your idea. Most customers will say, and that most people in that circumstance will say, yeah, that sounds like an interesting idea. And, you know, I think that focus groups are done much more scientifically than that, but still, a focus group only tells you as much as, you know, you have to be really, really specific just to get to the point where you're understanding that there might be something there. On the other hand, if people are willing to give you real money for a product, even if it's a discounted price because the product's not available, that means that they really believe. So we always, the best exchange that you can have with a consumer is an exchange of money.
So there's so many things I want to ask you about it, but I want to kind of back up and get to the place of like to get ready to sell. So there were 20 of you, right? I think in the First Build, you launched 12 products in 15 months. Yeah. What are the things that you think, aside from the, you know, ability to sell, but really kind of pre that, what went into that to make that possible? Because that is, I mean, I think it's not only astounding from a large company scale, but even if you're a startup, that's astounding.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to define what launching a product means. Our objective was to get these products out into the market and get to the point where we could have an exchange with a customer, a dollar exchange with a customer. A launch at First Build, when we first started up, meant anything from an email campaign where, you know, say we could set up a page and we had a little doodad. I'm trying to think of a good example. One idea that we had at one point was a shelf that would hold wine. It'd be a special place that would hold wine in your refrigerator. So we could build that in a prototype form very quickly, you know, come up with a couple different designs and then send out an email. So that's something that literally can be done very quickly. So that could be a product. Now, most of our products weren't that simple, but it could be. And legitimately, GE Appliances had questions like that over the years of, you know, what shelf should we launch? And usually those would go to consumer research. In this case, we would actually research it using real people and exchanging money. And then the other end of the spectrum would be we actually build from the ground up a major appliance. So First Build has done everything along that spectrum and called them product launches. So one of the first products that we launched was called the Green Bean. It was a little kit, maker kit for your appliances that would allow you to connect your computer to your appliance, and we had a software developer kit that would allow our kind of active maker community to turn on and off their fans and motors and adjust temperatures and stuff so that they can hack their appliances. So, you know, that type of a, we operated in an ethos where the different product, different launch types of launches matter. So how did we launch 12 products in 15 months? I think changing the way we looked at what the products were and changing the way that, we looked at what launch could mean. So for us, a launch really meant getting to exchanging the money. And so GE Appliances would never do a crowdfunding campaign, but it fit perfectly with what we were trying to do at First Build. And so within 6 months of launching First Build, we'd actually launched our first crowdfunding campaign for a temperature controlled cooktop that was a countertop cooktop. We made that, we launched a crowdfunding campaign in January of 2015, but we didn't ship the product until January of 2016. So we were able to launch a campaign because a marketing campaign is a lot easier to execute than a fully manufactured and shipped product. And then we use resources at GE Appliances, some of the hard work on that project done.
So I just want to back up for launch readers and just take a second, because you said it kind of quickly, but I think it is so critical to innovation and what, Taylor, I think you're talking about, the success that you guys had, that whole concept of defining launch. And I will tell you, and I've been in innovation for 25 years, but I'm totally guilty of this. When I first wrote the question and when I first read that, I was thinking like a launched product, meaning way further down the path. But what I hear you really saying is it's really launched for testing. It's not exactly launched for, you know, the kind of managing and sustainability of the product.
Yeah, the fundamental thing that we shifted, and it's a very uncomfortable shift to make, but once you do, it's very valuable, is the idea that a launch meant shipping a product. And to us, a launch means evaluating that there's a market for the product.
Yeah, I think that's a huge distinction. And I mean, I think you and I could probably have an entire podcast on why focus groups fail. But we'll do that another time, because they are the opposite of what you're talking about. And I think there are a lot of false reads, because sure, a lot of, I can't tell you the number of focus groups I've been engaged in and moderated where people, quote unquote, loved the product, were interested in the product. But the minute you asked them for money, even a dollar, it was a no. And then they gave you all the reasons why. And that's where you learn what works and what doesn't
work.
So
Our when we talk to our current clients, we're first focused around, can you define what you think a product should be? And can you get in front of a customer? Because almost always your first version of a product, the answer, and your first price point, the answer from the customer is no.
Yeah.
So you want to have something concrete you can put in front of a customer, get to the no, and then have the follow-up conversation of, okay, you said you didn't want to pay for it for this price. Why not? Is it the price point or is it the product?
Right.
What about the product?
Well, and I think you kind of alluded to it earlier, but it's really hard to test price in theory. I mean, if you asked, I mean, just to use an obvious example for launch readers that everybody would know, if you said to me, will you pay $6 for a cup of coffee? I'd be like, no way. But if you look at my credit card statement, how much I go to Starbucks or other cafes, apparently the answer is yes. So it's like, it's such a false read. I want to leap forward a little bit and talk a little bit about what you do now, because you take this concept and what you built with GE and you now apply it to other companies. So when you go into these companies, first of all, what do you see that they're trying to overcome? Why are they calling you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Our experience, I've been doing product development for 15 years now or so. So I'm, you know, kind of new to it, but I've also been doing it for a while. I've got enough experience to know kind of what the landscape looks like, especially the corporate landscape. And one of the things we found consistently at issue within specifically bigger corporations is there are a whole lot of really interesting ideas and projects going on. And only a small percentage of those projects actually get translated into product that's launched by those companies. And the reasons for that, there are many reasons for that. But one of the key reasons why that happens is because most companies are interested in maintaining the lines of business, the relationships with customers that they've already got, and find it pretty daunting to think about launching through new channels to new customers or launching products that are radically different than the products that they're comfortable with. So most companies are pretty good at optimizing and iterating on the stuff that they do, but they typically are very good at coming up with a new product. So that's where usually startups come in and they, you know, launch something and build something and they get acquired by a larger business.
Right.
But everyone wants to understand this problem of how do we actually grow stuff at home? Because if there's a lot of value created in creating homegrown innovation. And so most companies have an R&D lab, and a lot of stuff in the R&D lab doesn't get beyond the boardroom. Those ideas that exist that don't get beyond the boardroom, usually there's a lot of, first of all, you know, the biggest question is financially, how much money is this going to cost us to develop? And what is the
right.
likely turnaround or return that we're going to make on that investment? How long is it going to take us to recoup that investment? And the first question of how much is it going to cost is not too hard to answer. But the second question is impossible to answer. And so it's subject to a lot of speculation and a lot of people's opinions. And it really only takes one influential person to cast doubt on a project to say, hey, we can't.
Yeah, to shut it down.
So that is a pretty common problem. And so most companies have stuff that is kind of in the hopper that they're trying to get out. And fortunately, we're in a position where we've had several very successful products that we've launched first build. So people were coming to us a few years ago, starting up to last, like 2015, asking us how we were doing what we were doing. And the only answer we could give them was, you know, the answer I've given you. And then they want to know how to do it. And we say, well, go back and find $10 million to set up a new innovation lab and set up just like we did.
Right.
That doesn't really work for most people, right?
That's a high investment on the front end.
Even if you're
for uncertainty.
At the highest level of your business.
Yeah.
And so we started to realize, listen, the values that we've adopted to make this happen and the tactics that we've developed really would work across a broad range of industries. We focus primarily on companies that are launching hardware products because that's a really hard problem to solve, and it's something that we've been fairly successful at. But really what we try and do at Giddy is to help companies to get to launch. And for most projects that we look at, we've got a 100-day plan to get you from where you're at with your concept to getting something into the market where you can have it evaluated by real people with a real price point on a real payment platform. So we can evaluate whether or not there's a market for your product idea and get you the traction that you need in order to get the business moving forward with the project.
So I love this idea of a 100-day plan. What does the first, I was going to ask you what's the first step, but maybe the better question is, what's the first 10 days look like? How do you get this off the ground when that's not where they're coming from?
Yeah, that's a lot of fun because we operate on a very, very fast pace. And so it's almost uncomfortably fast.
Extremely,
I mean,
I'm sure.
We can get a landing page up where we can start, if we're doing it, say, a lead generation campaign that's leading up to, imagine it was a crowdfunding campaign. We can get that up and running in a day or two and start attracting people, whether it's, you know, their audience, an audience that's grown up through an influencer that we find, or we do buy some ads on Facebook or on Google. We can get that up and running within the first week of launching and start getting feedback from the world. So what lead generation looks like is basically, are people willing to give you their email address for a value proposition that you're offering them? And so that actually is an exchange of value. And so you're already starting now to capture and get a sense of whether people are interested in the product just by whether or not they're willing to engage in a future conversation with you about it. That's usually stage one. And then we can use that information to have a conversation with people. And we actually quite often are developing a product at the same time that we are starting to have this conversation with new potential customers. So the product literally could be changing and becoming more information coming available to our user base that we're growing as the campaign launches. And by the time we're at 100 days, we fully understand the product, the price point, the value proposition, and are ready to start taking money.
You know, I think one of the things that you're saying that is so important for launch readers out there to listen is that Taylor, you have that consumer from there from day one. It's not we do a bunch of stuff and then we go out to the consumer and then we come back and then we do a bunch of stuff. It's really from the first moment.
Yeah, like agreed. And that is part of this thing that's called customer discovery. So you don't necessarily, it's hard to go from zero to one, meaning it's hard to go from I don't have anyone who's interested or knows anything about me. And then all of a sudden I pop out of nowhere and I am asking you to pay $1,000 for, you know, a license to a piece of software or something like that. Unfortunately, the world doesn't really work like that. You have to build some credibility.
Yeah, and relationships.
With an audience and relationships with an audience. And so, and you also are better off if you started to have conversations with people early on who are exchanging some value, their time, their social credit by, you know, sharing with other people that are around them, their email address. And so you can kind of use smaller exchanges that you're having with people as a way to validate that you're on the right track.
Yeah. You know, it's your story is reminding me of years and years ago, I was working with Procter & Gamble on a potential new product, and it was a hair coloring product. And we rented kiosks in malls and set up the whole marketing thing to try to see if people would talk to us about this hair product that was in a box. And we had nothing in the box, actually. It was just the box. But that in itself was the most valuable from day one. That was before we got into kind of really delving into the products itself. Just having that piece of information at the front end, I think, drove us in the right direction versus had we just gone internally and tried to figure it out and then gone out to consumers and customers. We started with day one. Now, I will tell you, standing at a mall trying to get people to talk to you for 3 days is not fun.
No.
It's very valuable.
I didn't say that anything that we were doing is fun. So if you're going to do this, you have to be scrappy, and sometimes you have to do things that are uncomfortable and not any fun at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, your story reminds me of many of the projects that we've worked on. The first crowdfunding campaign we launched with a video of a basically a 3D shell of a product that looked really good that we knew we could make, but it had none of the we hadn't developed the product. In fact, it was a cooktop. I had made like a fake LCD screen, an 8-segment display or 7-segment display where you could actually cover up the segments of the numbers so you could change the apparent temperature on it. And we took different pictures and different shots of that. But if you would actually put a hot pan on top of this cooktop, it would melt the thing. So we had to shoot everything with, you know, cold pans and then make it use movie magic to make the thing look like it was a real thing. Because, you know, when you're operating on our mantra, it's always 9 days to product launch. So we came up with an idea. We wanted to launch it in 9 days. That means the campaign needs to be launched in 90 days. All you can do is make sure that you are comfortable that you're going to be able to engineer the product in the future.
What happens if you get to 100 days or 90 days and you don't have something that you can really get behind? Is that 100 days a test of this is really an idea or a product we should pursue or not?
Let's be honest. Most things don't take off.
Yeah.
So the answer is you pat yourself on the back for having done a good job of evaluating the project. You have learned something. You might be able to change courses and pivot and make some adjustments and say, okay, we're going to give this another month or another 90 days. But, you congratulate yourself for not having, for having done something that was innovative, tried it out, and not having spent $10 million or $100 million on launching the product.
Right, which is what would have happened if you start and go down the focus group path and build it internally and then officially launch it.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you a question about milestones, because one of my experiences from a couple of years ago now, but it always really stuck with me. So I was working on a joint venture with a product company in Europe to bring that product here through a company here. It's a consumer packaged goods company, a food company. And one of the things that I found really frustrating is the food company here, attached a milestone to this product, which would have been totally new to the American market, as well as a little bit of a shift in behavior. Basically, it was an apple juice that had bits of apple in it. And for us as Americans, that's weird. Like we don't eat our drinks that way. And in Europe, totally natural. One of the things that got in the way and I think ultimately killed the project for the company was that they attached a milestone to it that was basically the same as some of their legacy brands. So, you know, they expected to launch it and, you know, make it into a $500 million, billion-dollar business out of the gate versus having different milestones because it's new. It's a new invention. So I'm curious from your perspective where milestones fit into your plan and how you deal with that.
Well, I think that all milestones should be looked at in comparison with the amount of resources invested. So I think that it's unrealistic to expect that any project that you're working on that's a totally new line of business or a totally new channel, you know, say you've always sold only in big box stores and now you want to sell only, you want to try this on selling direct to consumers online, to expect that you're going to be on the same order of magnitude of business right. as that other business is kind of ridiculous. I mean, it could happen. It'll happen 1 out of 100 times maybe, or 1 out of 1,000 times. That's going to be a once in a lifetime event. I think what's more important is recognize that most great ideas, most new business start with small things, and you have to be very patient with slow starts. And as long as you have allocated an amount of resources that would justify continuing keeping going, look at what your timeline is for being cash flow positive on it. And I think it is realistic. I think it's appropriate to say we will only be interested in being in this business if we can be cash flow positive within a certain amount of time. And that would vary by industry. But expecting that it's going to be, you know, a major revenue driver within the first 90 days or even the first year or two, many projects aren't. I don't think that you look at the vast majority of successful startups and many of them take 5 to 7 years to really get off the ground. Even that's the successful one. So I think that you have to recalibrate your expectations on what milestones you're going to be able to achieve with some new business ideas. But again, that means just being really clear up front about what your objectives are financially, what your objectives are strategically, so that you can make sure that you are supporting and allowing and nurturing things to grow the way that they need to. But I think that the most important thing I would say is innovation requires a lot of patience and willingness to focus on one thing for a certain given amount of time. And you can identify what that amount of time that you want to focus on ideas, but it does require a lot of patience and people who are willing to champion ideas, even when the going gets tough, when the idea looks like it's not growing as fast as you might want it to.
Innovation requires patience kind of says it all. And it's funny because I think that if you look at these larger companies and they're very successful brands, those didn't grow overnight either. You know, they didn't become billion-dollar brands overnight. So it's this interesting juxtaposition of like, we want to launch new products, but we want them to be as successful as the ones that have been around for 30 years for us or 50 years for us. Overnight, it kills a lot of innovation, and I think your kind of comment about patience says it all. There's a couple questions I want to make sure we get into before we run out of time, because I read something that you wrote, an article, and this kind of blew my mind a little bit. It said you were making the comment that the only ideas that are left are the stupid ones.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, what the hell do we do about that?
Well, so this is an observation I've made over the last 4 or 5 years. Number one, I used to be under the conception that it was really all about having the great idea and pitching the idea to the right people and getting them to say, I want to do it. And what I found out as we deal with so many new products and we're trying to launch so many new things, and I found out that there really aren't a lot of new ideas. If you got the first, come up with the first great idea you've got, had the first new business idea, to Google, and there's 10 people doing it already. Right? So there's no new ideas. Everyone has the same ideas. And that means that probably so many people out there trying to launch new things, most of the good ideas have been taken. In fact, like the first ideas that are going to be taken are the low-hanging fruit, the really easy ones. Most of the easy stuff, the good stuff, has already been done. So I think that the ideas that are left are going to look pretty stupid to most people. And my experience has been that every project that I've worked on, that I've been talked to someone every single time, whether independent of future success or failure, someone told me this is a stupid idea. It's not going to work. So stupid ideas are the type of ideas that don't conform to the existing order of things. Quite often they require you to break things to get them to work, or people can come up with a counter narrative that's obviously to say that, hey, the thing that is currently working is exactly the opposite of what you want to do. So why do you think this is a good idea?
Right.
And so what I've found is if you are willing to champion an idea because you believe in it, you will find that there are people that you respect a lot who also think the idea is stupid.
You know, it's it reminds me, I don't know if you've ever done a Tough Mudder, but you probably heard of it.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, right? Those extreme sports. So, you know, it's for launch shooters out there, 10 to 12 miles, extreme obstacle things, shock wires, ice water. It's brutal. Team sport. What's fascinating to me, though, just to your point about stupid ideas, is he submitted his idea to he was at Harvard, the Will Dean, the founder, and he submitted his idea to a business plan competition at Harvard. So smart people, right? Smart professors. And they basically told him it will never work. Nobody would ever want this, you know, this kind of event. And just to shut it down, there's never going to be enough customers for it. In the meantime, it's I think last time I saw it evaluated, which was a year ago, was like a $6 billion business.
Yeah.
It's a great example of like other people think it's stupid. And I also think it's an example of what you were saying earlier about if you don't get out there and test it, you don't really know. On paper, it looks really crazy and stupid. And the professors were probably right. It probably did look like both of those things on paper. But he got out there and tested it with one event. Years later, here we are.
So the thing that I've learned is to completely isolate my opinions about a project's potential of success or failure from people's opinions about it. And that's a really important skill to have. And it's something that takes some time to develop. What's important is because I think as human beings, we like to be respected and we like to think that other people think we're smart. And someone might make an offhand comment about a project that you're working on and make you feel dumb, especially if it's someone that you really respect, and make you think, okay, maybe I should just throw in the towel. Well, that person's opinion doesn't matter. A good example of this is we wanted to launch a $500 ice maker on crowdfunding. And you don't see a whole bunch of $500 products in crowdfunding.
Right.
You don't see $500 ice makers that are countertop ice makers because the category is literally $100 or less category. But the only way that we could make this product work was by jacking the price up to $500 because it was a very costly product to make. So we said the only way this product's going to make any sense is if we charge $500. So we literally, that day, we started telling people, hey, we're going to make this product. It's going to cost $500. And 50% of people told us we were crazy. But the thing that was really exciting was that some people were saying, oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll take it whenever. Sign me up. And we had only that to go on, but also the fact that we just needed to launch a product. And so within 90 days, we'd launched this $500 nugget ice maker, and we made $3 million.
Wow.
And the funny part about that is that the day before we launched the campaign, we made $500,000 in the first day of the campaign. The day before we launched it, we were all sitting around in a room. There were 30 of us, and everyone was supposed to say how much money they thought we would make in this campaign. And so we went all the way around the room. The one person, the lowest bid was $250,000. The highest bid was $3 million. Literally, they got on the dot. Now, the person who guessed $3 million was the custodian. And the person who guessed $250,000 was the highest paid person in the room.
Oh my gosh.
Was the C-suite person. So it's not to say anything about people. Right?
Yeah.
Everyone has a different idea of the success or failure of a project. But you really don't know until you get out there and try it. And so the skill of being able to separate yourself and your opinions from the opinions of others and charge forward with a project is a really, really valuable skill to have.
I mean, I would never pay for a blanket with holes in it, but the Snuggie has made millions of dollars. So yeah, to your point, it's such a valuable lesson for launch readers out there to hear, because you really, and I've learned the hard way that you really, just because you would or wouldn't pay for it or like it or use it does not mean there's not a market. And I think what's more important to pay attention to is what are the trends and patterns out there, not what do you personally, would you personally invest in this product? I mean, I just wanted to pause there because I think, Taylor, that ability to separate yourself and say, let's test it, as opposed to here's what I think. And I can't tell you the number of probably possibly successful ideas that have been killed because the people sitting around the table, it wasn't for them. And they're not the customer. You know, in this case, like they don't know until they test. So I think that's so key.
I totally agree. And that goes directly with the experience that I've had as well.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, the Snuggie, I would never pay for that, but there you go. Millions of people will. So I was looking on your website and you have an app. Explain to me how that works.
Yeah. We didn't get a chance to go into this at all, but our history is really one of being open to ideas from the outside. And so when we launched Giddy a year ago, we launched, obviously we wanted to help businesses do, you know, launch new businesses. But one of the things that we learned through our experience was that there are a lot of people that are outside who can help you along the way. And so we've actually got a design community out there who can help us develop products.
Oh, cool.
And our clients will reach out to our community with a design brief that says, hey, we're looking to develop X, Y, or Z thing. So most recent example is an air filter company who is looking to develop a permanent air filter case that you can have a replaceable, recyclable air filter that goes inside that air filter case. And so they can reach out and get a lot of new ideas for a new product within a very short amount of time. So usually it's 21 days, you'll come back and have 20 to 25 new designed products that you can then choose from. You work with the community, you pay some prize money, and then you are able to turn around and build the product that they've helped develop. And this is actually really important because, you know, a lot of people use the word design thinking as a buzzword. It's kind of hard for companies to figure out how to do that on a sustainable basis. And we found that a great way to get the first ideas for what your new product should be and what it could look like is to explore the solution space completely. And you can do that very efficiently and very effectively by working with a community, because the ability to look through 20 or 25 different iterations that you get in literally 3 weeks really can have a big impact on the final product. And it's actually a discipline that we went into and we used at First Build on almost all the products we launched.
You know, I love it. It's almost like a 99 designs, but for actual product development. And I think it's very cool because I think a lot of people get stuck in that, well, how do I bring this to life? That initial phase kills a lot of ideas because people just don't know how to get it off paper into something actually working or somewhat working.
Well, yeah. I mean, the one thing that when you start developing a product, if you've got one industrial designer and an engineer working on your first concept, the thing that usually happens is you've started all the other ways to solve the problem.
That's right. Yeah.
Paper of one, and usually drained by resources. And so you move forward with some close iteration to that one. And we found that if you work closely with our community, you can actually get a whole bunch of different designs and choose the best things. And that has a strong impact on the final design that you launch.
Yeah, that's very cool. So on that note, where can people go to learn more about all this and connect with you?
The easiest way for people to connect with me right now is just connect with me on LinkedIn, reach out and send a message, and we'll have an opportunity to talk. We really enjoy having discussions with people anywhere from, hey, you want to come and see what we've done with First Build, all the way to, are you interested in having a longer term relationship with Giddy and figuring out how we can help you launch a product?
So this has been fantastic. My last question for you is, what's the one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there looking to accelerate their innovation efforts?
Education. Your education is something that you take upon yourself. And the only way to really move forward is to stand on the shoulders of the people who've gone before you. There's a lot to learn. And so there's podcasts, there's books, there are websites, there's reaching out to people. Literally, I would say, you know, if you've heard anything that I've said that is interesting, I would love to also talk to people who are interested in learning some of the things that we've learned from.
That is fantastic, Taylor. Thank you so much. This has been so insightful. And I just, like I was saying, I really come to recognize this different definition of launch as being a critical factor for why some initiatives make it and some don't. Because they're working towards that final launch, not kind of how you're defining it as more of a testing opportunity. And that just kind of blew my mind. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm glad to invite you. Thanks for having me on tomorrow.
All right, before you go, what's the one thing that you're going to do based on the insights from this podcast from Taylor? What are you going to do to mimic some of the successes that he had? I think we all know that that is part of the experimentation and optimization. So what ideas can you experiment with? What ideas can you optimize? You've heard me say it time and time again. If you've been listening to my podcast for a while, you know I'm big into experimentation. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning, Taylor's innovator archetype is risk taker, tweaker. If the way he spoke about things, some of the way he approached his work actually resonated with you, if you find yourself to be that kind of person who's willing to raise your hand and say, I disagree and be uncomfortable in the meeting when everybody's, you know, ideas are going in the other direction, or you're the one willing to kind of leap and figure it out, or maybe you're the one who can kind of look at the idea and make it better. You can see that little shift that's going to change everything. You might be a tweaker. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to our website, click on Take Assessment, and I want you to find out what you are. Let's see if you're a risk taker, tweaker. If Taylor really resonated with you, it might be the case. And then you can leverage your innovator archetype to go further, faster.